Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News.
Atop the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all-important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
A Vancouver couple is accused of imprisoning adopted teenage twins. An environmental group claims that Disneyland is a poisonous pit of danger, and police are hunting escaped lions and tigers in Ohio.
As always, my friends, at the end of this hour of ideological discourse and intellectual screed, you will find yourself enraptured, shocked, amazed, and demonstrably more intelligent. And now, prepare yourselves, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Taylor. This is absolutely everything you need to know for Wednesday, October 19th, 2011. Police arrested a Tillamook man Tuesday afternoon on accusations of dealing pot in Chapman Square Park, site of the Occupy Portland tent city. I am shocked to find out that there is pot dealing going on in the Occupy Portland tent city.
It's a target-rich environment.
Police said they thought they saw a man drinking alcohol in the park around 3:15 p.m. When officers approached, he hid a glass jar. He voluntarily left the park with police and showed officers what he was hiding. It was a canning jar with several bags of marijuana. Timothy Taldani, 36, was booked for delivery of marijuana and drugs in a city park. His bail was set at $22,500. And in a Quinnipiac University poll released Monday, two-thirds of New York City voters said that they actually support the Occupy Wall Street protests. The backers included 81% of Democrats and, perhaps more surprisingly, 35% of Republicans. And an overwhelming majority, 87%, said, quote, it's okay that they're protesting.
Well, because we can burgle their homes while they're gone. I think it's why everybody would be on board. I mean, I think here's what I'm surprised.
More people
by.
In the parks, less people in their houses.
I am surprised that there has not been a massive spike in the number of home invasions and burglaries that have taken place. And I'm serious, because if you see somebody at the Occupy Wall Street thing anywhere, you know that there's probably nobody at their house, or there are fewer people at their house, and the odds that you're going to be caught by somebody going in, as you're going in the back window to take their television, are demonstrably less.
And they're probably tweeting about it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not home.
Seriously.
I'm 5 miles away from my house, sitting around in a park all day.
It astounds me that we have not seen that, and it will astonish me if by the time this is all over, there has not been at least one or two news stories about how people have gone home from the Occupy Wall Street protest, or wherever it is they are, occupying, Basilton, and they go home and, and like all of their crap is gone. Or conversely, that will be merged together, that will be conflated with the story about how Twitter is being used by thieves. When I'm surprised we haven't had that story already over the past year or so. Twitter being used by thieves to track when people are home and when they're not, so they know exactly when to go by and run out the back door with their Xbox.
Well, there's a website. I haven't heard anything about it for a while, but there's a website where someone was actually trying to make that very point, where he set up a bot that when people tweet about how they're not home, or they use like Foursquare or something to say where they actually are, it would be on the site. And he was using it as an illustration of, and it was called like robmyhouse.com or
awesome.
Something like that, to show it's like, when you tell people you're not home, you're telling strangers you're not home.
Exactly.
So But anyway, for all the criticism lobbed at the protesters for not having a formal list of demands, their general message seems to be getting across. Nearly three quarters of New York City voters said they understand the protesters' views very well, or fairly well. Respondents split evenly on whether police are handling the protests well, however. 37% of New York City voters fingered George W. Bush as the one to blame for the nation's economic mess, while 21% blamed Wall Street, 18% Congress, and 11% President Obama. These figures are probably not representative of the nation at large, however. The survey's demographic shows that 55% of those polled were Democrats, while only 13% were Republicans.
I myself choose to finger Jenna Bush.
Ew. Ew. Okay. Damage caused by the Occupy Portland encampments in Lounsdale Square and Chapman Park will cost the city at least $19,000 in several months to repair, according to Commissioner Nick Fish. The city leader sent a letter to Occupy Portland on Monday, urging them to make changes that
How do you send a letter to Occupy Portland?
Just guys at park, and just it'll
just
get
put
there.
A picture of, you just put a picture of Arlo Guthrie on the front and say, deliver to the guys who look like this.
You know, a picture of a tent and a couple of stick figures, you know.
It's just... Seriously, what? It's not like it's an LLC or something. It's not like they're the Oddfellows Lodge. How is it you deliver a letter to Outlook? I keep saying Outlook Portland, but Occupy Portland.
I don't know.
Okay.
You just send a guy down there with a letter and say,
but who would you
hand
it to?
Who's in charge?
Well, clearly the answer would be nobody, because that would be fascism or something.
Well, it's not the guy with the pot, because he's in jail now.
Well, he has people, I would imagine. He has a signs.
Well, in the letter,
delivered to no one,
Nick Fish urged them to make changes that will minimize the strain on the parks. Parks belong to everyone, he said. The cost to restore the damage to our parks will not be borne by Wall Street bankers, but by Portland taxpayers. He said due to the damage, the encampments were actually hurting the very people that Occupy Portland has aimed to engage and represent. Damaging these much-loved shared open spaces is frankly inconsistent with your stated goals of renewing our democracy and restoring power to ordinary people.
Now, here's the thing. When he says that their stated goals are renewing our democracy, which, by the way, is a phrase that means nothing. Nothing at all in any way. In any context, it is renewing democracy is the sort of thing that a politician says when he has no idea what it is people are actually talking about, but he knows that it's sort of vaguely positive. You were saying earlier that when there was like in New York, people said that they were in fact actually well aware of what Occupy Wall Street's goals
are. They said they believe they understand what their goals are.
This is like when you ask cigarette smokers why they tap the pack of cigarettes, and you will get nine different answers from nine different people. The test is if you could get all those New Yorkers in separate rooms and ask them if their answers would all match. And I would bet you dollars to donuts that they wouldn't. That if you took 10 people off the street who said they knew exactly what the goals were with specificity and had them answer without anybody else within earshot, that none of them would actually have overlapping answers.
Quite possibly.
Except to renew things and to generally be zinky.
Spokespeople, by the way, from Occupy Portland have come out and said, after Nick Fish's letter, that they will be happy to help to reseed the park and do what they need to do to, like, you know, fix the park back up. But I don't know. I don't know who they think is going to pay the $19,000. But anyway.
Maybe they can get pirates to do it. They seem to bear the brunt of all the city's reseeding costs.
Yes, exactly. They have experience in doing it as well.
Totally send pirates down there just to, I don't know, question mark and then step three, hilarity.
Because whenever you get hippies and pirates together, mayhem ensues.
I'm really unsure what side the pirates would be on. I really don't know. I'm
their own side, really. The side of the pirates.
The side of the pirates.
Yeah.
Okay, no. Fair enough.
The Occupy Wall Street protesters have found an unexpected advocate in former top stock analyst Henry Blodgett. The founder of the website Business Insider says they have a right to be upset that corporate profits are at an all-time high.
What kind is that?
Occupy One.
People are getting less. Corporations are doing incredibly well, but average Americans are not seeing that. And we've hit an extreme now with unemployment over 9% where people are saying we've had enough.
The founder of the website says the inequality in the economy hasn't reached this level since the late 1920s.
That was solved by, unfortunately, the Great Depression, changes in the tax code, long period of prosperity in the 50s and 60s. So a lot of people think we've got to just tweak things and get more equality.
We have to tweak things.
We have to tweak
things. We're not refreshing them.
No.
Or what was it? What was we doing? We
were renewing.
Renewing. Sorry.
Renewing democracy.
Renewing.
We're basically slapping a nice, shiny new coat of paint on the outside of democracy.
We're Martinizing democracy. That's really what it is. It's Simonizing on top of that. Hello, you're listening to Legion of News. It is Tuesday. No, it's not.
No.
It's Wednesday,
yeah.
October 19th, 2011. Thank you for coming by. Coming up later on this hour, get your entertainment news and science on the march. And as later on this hour, you can also get this program later on the day via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com. And next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program. Is that?
Yep.
That's today?
Yep.
Today at RickEmersonShow.com, Nazi Watch, Taser Watch, A Geek Watch, and more. That is at RickEmersonShow.com. You know, $19,000 does seem excessive for grass seeds.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. It seems like that. All you really need is a handful of seeds and then a guy that just, with one of those little things with the crank that just sort of flings the seeds everywhere.
I got $6,000 to paint one of those, like, couple of green stripes for a bike box. I mean, you know, city works are expensive.
The slightest bit of graft taking place here, I think.
By the way, Robert Wagner has suggested on the Twitter that a new drinking game for me is that you should take a shot whenever I say Occupy. So we need to do more Occupy fill-in-the-blank stories.
Now, is there something specific about that word, or is it just that it seems to be cropping up with great regularity in the news?
It's just coming up a lot in the news.
Okay. Done and done.
Occupy, occupy, occupy.
No, see, now you can't just you can't stack the deck like that. It's got to be organic. It's got to naturally occur.
Flow naturally in the conversation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Should I get a sounder to sort of, so as people become drunker?
Well, actually, we're kind of done for today, but tomorrow. Everyone should be prepared tomorrow.
Well, you don't want to give it away, though.
No.
You want to make, you know, let people think that it might at any point, you know.
That's true.
You should throw it in occasionally, like an Easter egg.
And who knows? Some of these other stories from today may involve someone occupying a space of some sort.
See, right there, for example, just in sort of a forward promotion, you've actually,
exactly.
You've laid it in one more time.
Sort of an illustration of the basic premise.
So if people sort of, but if they start to slur things in some sort of an, it wouldn't be auditory, it would be auditory. So if they're getting sort of an ear slur going on as they get drunker and drunker, we could throw in a little like.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll think.
Everyone loves that. Right. Or the mouth singing.
Oh, just the Inuit.
Yeah. No.
You know, here's the thing
no one wants to hear that.
Not even me. I find it normally the things that everybody else finds really irritating or off-putting or unpleasant. Let's say, you know, just like your random sort of. I find fantastic. But even I am off-put by the Inuit mouth singing. There's just something really.
Isn't all singing mouth singing, by the way?
Yeah, I guess. I think it's technically throat singing.
Well, same thing, though. You're still using your. All singing is throat singing.
But I think it's more in like a. kind of a way.
Oh, okay. A Vancouver, Washington couple is accused of imprisoning their adopted twins and only feeding them once a day. Jeffrey and Sandra Weller have been charged with 5 counts of second-degree assault and 2 counts of unlawful imprisonment. The twins, who were homeschooled, have been placed in protective custody. Court documents say the two 16-year-olds were emaciated and the parents restricted their access to food, keeping all food under lock and key and letting the children eat only small amounts, usually only once a day. The teens told detectives that they would steal extra food when they were severely punished, including being forced to lay on the kitchen floor with no pants or underwear while being struck repeatedly on the buttocks with a wooden spoon, often resulting in bleeding. The teens told police this abuse took place an average of once a week and had been going on for several years. A neighbor, Colleen Lefevre, who apparently it took a while for her to figure out that anything was going on, this neighbor, she says, "You could tell they were neglected, really skinny. It was sad to watch."
Okay.
I think Colleen Lefevre needs to be beaten with a wooden spoon.
It appeared to be somewhat entertaining to watch as well, since she seemed to passively elongate the.
Yeah, something terrible is going on over there. I wish someone would do something. Someone who was aware of it.
Maybe she thought they were just staging an in-house production of Flowers in the Attic or something.
The teens also said the interior knob on their bedroom door had been removed from the bedroom they shared, preventing them from leaving the room. Police also found an alarm installed on the door and a lock on the window. Court documents report there were no lights in the room and all electricity to the room had been cut off. Someone in the family had to let them out for them to leave the room that they shared.
Seriously, everybody in this story except the kids themselves needs to be horsewhipped.
Yeah. Court documents indicate that Jeff Weller punished the 16-year-old twin sister first by beating her 20 times with a wooden stick, and then while she was on her hands and knees by strangling her. Apparently, also, there were filthy living conditions. The officer interviewed the couple. They said they blamed the locks and the filthy conditions on the children.
I was just going to say, on the kids themselves.
And explained the children's skinny stature as due to them being Filipino.
Well, they've got fast metabolisms, Don.
Yes.
It's their thyroid is such that they're a slender people.
And they're a lazy people who don't clean the house nearly as well as they should.
Also, we beat them with spoons and don't feed them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that as well, but mainly the Filipino thing. Seriously, they got to be beaten with a chair.
Yes. They go in the book. Right. You don't have the book anymore.
I didn't. I stopped bringing the book in because it was just making me tense. It was just making me. The book was just filling me with agita. And so I just. It's in my garage at home.
Okay.
It's there, just sitting, sort of just glowing and glowering.
Right.
You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm.
Someday after your death or after your arrest or something, they will just found this book with filled with names of people. And it's.
He said he'd stop putting people in it, but at home there'll be there'll be a room, you know, like that room in Seven. You know, we're like a Kevin Spacey room just overflowing with notebooks where it's just filled with, you know, thousands of names.
And their sins.
Guy looked at me for half a second too long on the street today. By the way, the book, for the people who don't know what we're talking about, the book was the thing that we used in the last incarnation of the... In fact, it wasn't. In fact, I think we'd actually kind of stopped using it by the time we moved to KUFO, where it would probably not have played anyway. At the AM 97, the incarnation of the Rick Emerson Show, we had this sort of leather-boundish sort of book in which we put the names of people who would be dealt with eventually in the appropriate fashion at the appropriate time. So, and by the way, it's like even if I don't ever add another name to the book, I got like 17 pages full of names in there, so it's like I'm not going to lack for activity someday later on. You know, when I really need something to fill the
the hours.
No. See, you said that. I didn't say that. I have never, in fact, said what the appropriate punishment or treatment or handling might be. It's just that they will be dealt with.
You could just send them stale baked goods.
Exactly.
So that they would be disappointed.
I've never even really specified that it's a punishment of any kind. I've just said that it's a book full of people who will be dealt with in the appropriate fashion at the appropriate time in the future. Everything else is just conjecture.
All right.
I'm just saying there will be a reckoning and there will be an adding up and there will be a tallying. Oh, yes. Okay.
The city of Zanesville, Ohio is on lockdown.
I want to live in Zanesville.
Zanesville. Three school districts were closed Wednesday. Motorists were warned to stay in their vehicles, and over 50 heavily armed law enforcement officials are scouring the area because 48 exotic animals, including lions, tigers, cheetahs, wolves, cougars, and bears, escaped from a private zoo last night. The owner of the Muskingum County Animal Farm, Terry Thompson, was found dead on the property with the animals' cages open and the farm's fences left unsecured. It's a possibility that Thompson commits suicide after opening the cages. County Sheriff's Department administered an overnight shoot-to-kill order for the exotic animals. Muskingum County Sheriff Matt Lutz told...
Zanesville is in Muskingum County.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Matt Lutz told ABC News that as of early this morning, his officials had shot and killed 25 animals in what has essentially become a big game hunting expedition.
Through the streets of Zanesville.
Uh-huh. A local resident says everyone is worried that they're still on the loose.
Nobody really knows what an animal out of a caged area would do.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go.
Mr. and Mrs. Zanesville speak.
Between 30 and 35 animals are accounted for, and there may be animals still loose on the property, although anywhere between 8 and 15 of them, many of them big cats, are still roaming the countryside. Heavy overnight rain only made things worse. The order was lifted Wednesday morning, and police officers armed with tranquilizer guns are continuing their search. Lutz described, Muskingum County Sheriff Matt Lutz himself saying that many types of animals are still missing.
Just be aware. Be aware of their surroundings. Know that this is going on. School's canceled today. Make sure you know where your kids are at. Make sure they're not out, in the wooded areas.
This is the best town in which you could possibly live, I guess, unless you're an animal of some kind. Because how often do you get to, sit there at school and then you're evacuated because a zebra might be sort of stampeding through the whole thing?
One police officer was attacked by a bear, and it had to be put down. Officers are patrolling the heavily wooded areas in cars and trucks as it is still too dangerous to be out on foot. Owner Thompson had reportedly been experiencing legal and marital problems. He was only just released from prison, and he and his wife are separated. His neighbor, Danielle White, told MSNBC he was in hot water because of his animals, because of permits, and the animals escaping all the time. A few weeks ago, she said she had to avoid some camels which were grazing on the side of the freeway.
Why are we just now finding out about this town now that they're shooting everything? It seems like it's too late. I wish we would have known about this place a month ago.
Yeah. Ohio, by the way, has some of the nation's weakest restrictions on exotic pets and among the highest number of injuries and deaths caused by them.
That's hard to imagine.
So if you're going to get killed by a lion in the United States, odds are it will be in Ohio.
Zanesville seems like a magical place where you can just walk in. There's just a polar bear just standing next to you at 7-Eleven for
it's
no
like
reason.
Lost all the time.
Exactly. Wow.
Apparently, there's also another quote here, but the description I have of it has something to do with Herman Cain, and I don't think that's right.
No, he's...
So I think we have another sound.
He's probably not chasing after an escaped zebra. No. That, in fact, I'm pretty sure that is... I think that's actually just future reference. I think that's actually supposed to be the third quote with the debate. There's two debate quotes, and I think he's the third one. I think that's...
Okay.
I put that on the wrong page or something.
All
but
right.
Unless he is just a big game hunter and we don't really know about it. Like, that's one of his men. He's like Vladimir Putin. He's out there with a harpoon and just, 999, whomp, into a beluga whale.
I don't think any beluga whales have escaped from an animal farm in Ohio.
Well, I'm not that we spotted yet, but it seems you wouldn't think a camel would just be in somebody's front yard
true.
Either. And yet, Zanesville on the Muskingum County line tonight on NBC.
Mayor Sam Adams held an open house last week to get feedback on the development of a parking plan in Northwest Portland. People who live and work in the area have had problems with parking for more than 20 years. Suggestions for handling the high volume.
As long as they're on that, like, right away. As long as they're Johnny on the spot with the solution.
We noticed that you've been having some problems with parking over here in Northwest, which I'm sure got much, much better when we spent, like, 2 years putting in a light rail line.
Your grandpappy told me that it was difficult to find a parking space here. We thought we'd finally do something about it.
Suggestions for handling the high volume of traffic in the district include installing parking meters and increasing the number of spots that require permits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'll help. That would also lower the number of free parking space available. So that'll
help. That doesn't really seem like a clever solution.
No. So Mayor Adams said he wants to settle on a solution by the end of October.
Or, a week or two after he's out of office. Somebody notes that, what would have been great is hearing the man on the street interview just as the interviewee gets attacked by a wild animal. That would have been great.
It's really dangerous around here. What with all the... Okay.
Jenkins went on to say that...
All right. Here's a story that we did not get to read to you yesterday because we weren't here.
That's right.
A dispute between an East Portland man and his relatives on Monday led to a reported assault with a pickup truck, then a fight with machetes, rakes, posts, and pipes. Portland police detectives have charged 48-year-old Sylvester Bridges. 48. Thank you, KGW, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Portland police detectives have charged 48-year-old Sylvester Bridges, 48. With three counts of third-degree assault in the incident. Police were dispatched about 8:30 a.m. Monday to 160th and East Burnside on the report of an assault with a knife. Arriving officers learned of a fight between Bridges and several teenagers. Police said one of the teenagers was...
Was this Battle Royale or something? Was he...
Well, one of the teens was the 17-year-old son of Bridges' girlfriend, and the others were cousins.
So it's just like a whole...
Is kind of a West Side Story thing. I'm not sure what's going on.
Don't shtup my mom fight.
The teens started banging on the sides of Bridges' pickup truck, then walked to the Burnside corner. Bridges then drove to the corner and struck three of the boys with his truck at slow speed. Bridges returned home, followed by the teens. Bridges then pulled out a machete, hit one of the teens, and the fight escalated with rakes, PVC pipe, and big posts.
The guy who has the PVC pipe really got the short end of the stick there. He drew the shortest of the straws.
He picked up the last thing.
I guess I'll just use this balsa wood airplane.
The father was detained by police, and the teens were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. None were serious, and Bridges was scheduled to be arraigned yesterday in Multnomah County Court.
Where are these guys in these stores getting machetes from? Where do you buy that?
The machete store. Machete World over on Hawthorne Boulevard.
You can probably buy one at the state fair, but when the fair's
much machetes.
Not in town, I don't... It's like butterfly knives, which I think are only sold at state fairs.
I actually found a machete when I moved into the house I bought. There was one in the old beaten-up garage.
Right next to the hydroponic setup?
Yeah. Well, no, that's the place I live now.
Oh, okay.
No, the house that I bought had had old gun casings and an enormous old glass hypodermic needle and a machete in the garage when I moved in. But anyway... Oh, no, you're right. That house did have the hydroponic setup in the basement. I keep moving. moving into places where people have been growing weed.
Wait, now
what
I don't even know.
What the hell is that about?
I don't even know what we're talking about now. Are you talking about the place now?
Well, the place now, yeah. There was the grow stuff when I moved in.
But not a machete.
But I realized the house that I bought like 20 years ago, yeah, there was the weird room in the basement with the fluorescent lights and the water being piped in. Apparently, every place I move in this town
was some sort of a Gestapo interrogation room.
I guess.
Okay.
Anyway, I got off on this whole hydroponic machete thing, and now I don't know what I'm doing anymore. Let's do some science.
Here's your science on the march for whatever the hell day this is. Wednesday, October 19th, 2011.
Korean scientists have come up with a way to make electronic hardware truly spill-proof. Kim Jung-young, a chemical engineering professor at the Pohang University of Science and Technology in South Korea, said, "This is a kind of new approach combining nanowire super hydrophobicity with next-generation memory devices."
There's no super hydrophobicity.
It's
not
it
a real thing.
Super hydrophobicity.
Uh-huh.
Young's lab researches nanomaterials and their applications for electronics, including tiny next-generation memory devices used in nanoelectronics. His group has also spent several years using nanowires to fabricate super hydrophobic surfaces.
Expialidocious.
Which means they cause water to bead up and bounce off. This is the same phenomenon that naturally occurs on lotus flowers. One day, it struck Young that he should try to combine these two areas of research, create next-gen devices with super hydrophobic surfaces. In the lab, Young and his colleagues constructed a resistive switching memory device covered in nanorods made from zinc oxide. Each tiny rod was placed on the surface's device surface like a bristle. Together, the aligned nanorods acted like a waxy layer of a plant, and the nanorods, separated by pockets of air, kept water droplets off the device like a crowd bouncing beach balls.
So it's if you spill onto something.
Right.
When you're saying spill-proof device, I thought it was like a thing, like a Weeble somehow that couldn't be tipped over.
No, it's so that, like, if you use this on your laptop or your smartphone or something, it won't.
Right.
Yeah, go on.
So it is like an oleophobic device, but with water.
Only super hydrophobic.
Okay.
"Our experiments showed this new concept works very well," he said, adding that other waterproof coatings exist but require relatively complicated processes to make. Young's straightforward method, however, allows chemical engineers to easily create dry surfaces with well-placed nanorods. Young said, "Everybody knows water is fatal in operation with electronic devices. Our work suggests the possibility of overcoming the water vulnerability of electronic devices." An extremely rare 22-inch long cyclops shark has been confirmed in Mexico. The 22-inch long fetus has a single functioning eye at the front of its head, the hallmark of a congenital condition called cyclopia, which occurs in several animal species, including humans. Earlier this year, fisherman Enrique Lucero León legally caught a pregnant dusky shark near Sorolvo Island in the Gulf of California. When León cut open his catch, he found the odd-looking male embryo along with its 9 normal siblings. He said, "That's incredible! Wow!
Kill it with fire!"
So pictures of this started circulating around on the web, and according to numerous other media reports, it is actually true. The photos first surfaced at the Pisces Fleet Sports Fishing blog on Facebook, and many people thought the images were too bizarre to depict anything legitimate. But National Geographic shares that two scientists from the Interdisciplinary Center of Marine Sciences in Mexico have studied the specimen and have determined it's a 22-inch long dusky shark fetus with a single functioning eye.
By the way, you can see this at rickemerson.com/pictures because Cheryl Kanakoa decided to bless/curse us with these yesterday. So it's really creepy. You can see it at rickemerson.com/pictures visual aids for 10/19. This is for October 19th. I mean, I never doubted that it was real, but the world is full of insane, terrifying things that should not be. And so this is just like the latest in a long line. But really, it's... Oh, I didn't see that your caption for this was actually "kill it now." Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think that's possible, though.
No.
It
actually did not make it, because the shark was caught, he cut it open, there were the fetuses of the shark inside. One was a cyclops. And apparently it would not have lived had it been born.
That's
anyway.
What we tell ourselves.
Because... when like one-eyed kittens, I guess, are born with some regularity, and they never live. And then the dusky shark, as soon as the sharks are born, they're just sort of kicked out to fend for themselves. And so it's doubtful that the one-eyed baby shark would have survived.
But occasionally you get like a Jason Crump, you know, style shark or kitten or whatever. And then it lives and just feeds on those around it and then kills all in its path.
New Hampshire. So anyway, yes, over at rickeverson.com pictures, you can see the horror that is the Cyclops shark.
It's sort of cute, though.
It's sort of adorable and sort of horrifying.
I kind of wish I had like sort of a plushy, squeaky doll of it, like I'm a one-eyed, you know, and then it's sort of great. I mean, I kind of feel bad that it's not going to grow up to swim around and terrorize people.
Well, it only has one eye, but it's one really huge, very cute eye.
Well, that's the thing, is it's like it's a giant eye.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it sees just as much, if not more, than we see.
New Hampshire native Renee Nicole Duchour, 58, experienced stroke symptoms in late August while working as an engineer at an Antarctic research station for federal contractor Raytheon Polar Services Company. After almost 2 months of ongoing vision and speech problems, she was airlifted early Monday to a hospital in New Zealand. Duchour wrote in an email to the Associated Press, "My brain is still intact," and said she is scheduled for medical tests on Tuesday. Officials rejected her initial request for an emergency evacuation in August, citing frigid winter temperatures and high winds that could make the trip dangerous for pilots, coupled with the judgment that Duchour's condition was not life-threatening. The company told the Associated Press that the decision not to evacuate the engineer was made by the National Science Foundation, which is the federal agency employing Raytheon. Duchour and her family were outspoken in their disagreement with the decision, probably saying something like, "I'm having a stroke, and I'm in the Antarctic.
I'm seeing dead relatives."
They organized a webpage and a Facebook page and a petition that accumulated over 1,000 signatures. Duchour's niece, Sydney Raines, said in a New York Times article earlier this month, "By what standard is a stroke considered a non-emergency?"
Seriously.
So in the period between the stroke and the evacuation on Monday, Duchour reported having difficulty reading and recalling simple words during evaluations with doctors at the research station. She was also on medical leave from her job and receiving breathing treatments while stranded in Antarctica.
Maybe they were just waiting for her to have, for the stroke to be severe enough that she'd forget how to sue.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we'll give you some leave. Have some medical leave.
I have a lawyer.
That's
if only
great.
I could remember his name.
I'm still in Antarctica.
Bastards.
And finally, four U.S. senators and health officials from the cities hosting the World Series are urging the Baseball Players Union to agree to a ban on chewing tobacco at games and on camera. The senators, including number 2 Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois and health officials from St. Louis and Arlington, Texas, made the press the pleas in separate letters obtained Tuesday by the Associated Press. The World Series between the Texas Rangers and the St. Louis Cardinals begins in St. Louis on Wednesday night. The senators wrote to union head Michael Weiner, "When players use smokeless tobacco, they endanger not only their own health, but also the health of millions of children who follow their example." The signers were fellow Democrats Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, and Senate Health Committee Chairman Tom Harkin of Iowa. The senators noted that millions of people will tune in to watch the series, including children. They wrote, "Unfortunately, as these young fans root for their favorite team and players, they also will watch their on-field heroes use smokeless tobacco products." With baseball's current collective bargaining agreement expiring in December, the senators, some government officials, and public health groups like the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids want the players to agree to a tobacco ban in the next contract. The senators wrote, "Such an agreement would protect the health of the players and be a great gift to your young fans."
I'm sorry. It's just the same crap we hear every year. Here's the only thing that will ever work. Other than being exposed to somebody firsthand that chews tobacco, which is when, of course, you realize that it's like the most horrifying habit on earth.
Oh, yeah, it is disgusting.
If they really wanted to solve this, all they would just do is just have like you could solve the chewing tobacco, quote, problem. One fell swoop, 1 30-second spot. It'd be like that Ridley Spot commercial for Apple in 1984. You air it once, done, problem solved. It's like 30 seconds worth of chicks on camera going, "Chew tobacco, I'm never going to F you. I'm never, ever, 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 ever. There's a chance that I, you know, if you're moderately attractive or just, you know, maybe know how to play Freebird, I might have relations with you. But if you chew tobacco, I'm going to find you physically off-putting in every way, and it's never going to happen. Bye." The end. That's it. Because I don't know a single girl. I mean, they must exist somewhere, presumably in Georgia, but I've never known a single girl that was like, "Ooh, mouthful of tobacco juice. Let me get me some of that." No. That's what I'm saying.
Nauseating.
So it's like, that's all that. In fact, you wouldn't even really need to convince the guys. It'd be like, what is it, Lysistrata? All you have to do is just convince the women. Be like, hey, do you really want to stick your tongue in this? No. And so then the guys follow suit and go, well, I guess we better stop it then.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
I agree.
All right.
Let's get on that.
All right.
That's all the science.
There you go. That's all the science. There's no more.
No.
It's gone. It's done. And that was, again, the entertainment news bed. That's like the second time we've done that and neither of us noticed. Because
no.
This is the science bed.
That's right.
All right. And this is the bed for tobacco chewing. So I'm trying to give it a negative association
right.
for
That's
people, fair. For kids, for children.
For the kids.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. Police and animal control. Oh, we already did that.
What?
That was the tiger thing.
Well
Don't want
to
do the tiger thing again.
Bet in a thousand.
Oh, no, I had it aside because of the Herman Cain mess up. Texas Congressman Ron Paul is among the seven Republican presidential candidates who took part in Tuesday's debate in Las Vegas. Paul says he's not a big fan of the 999 tax proposal being pushed by competitor Herman Cain.
But if you play it backward, you get your money back.
People who are going to get a 9% sales tax and they don't even have jobs right now. So I think because it's so regressive, that's going to, if we ever came close to it, it'd be very, very unpopular.
I don't even get a chuckle for that. That's like two jokes in one.
I know. It was good.
Well, whatever.
I'm busy. I'm
laughing on the inside.
Yeah. Paul says his goal was to push his economic plan, not to attack Herman Cain or any other candidates.
Clue. That's why he doesn't win.
I've had some advisors tell me that. Go after him, attack him. But that's my least favorite thing to do. I will when I'm pressed and I'm challenged, or if they challenge my supporters.
Wow, what was that? What was that weird little...
It was like a little Bruce Banner thing he did there at the end.
The gentleman supporter.
Rip out your thorax. Oh.
Herman Cain was at the center of a pylon as the debate began. His GOP...
center of a pylon?
A pylon.
Just did it transport him to the Lost City?
Yes.
I have to say about tech. Holy God, they're a sleaze stack!
His GOP rivals took turns picking apart his 999 plan to reform the United States tax code. The plan would throw out the current tax system and implement a 9% corporate income tax, a 9% income tax, and a 9% national sales tax. Cain defended it against the current tax code.
Let's throw out the 10 million word mess and put in our plan, which will liberate the American workers and liberate American businesses.
I guess that means something good would happen for us.
I guess that's defending it, but that's not really telling
really
us
anything. Saying anything
you didn't
about
say
it.
Anything.
No.
Okay. Police in Chickasha, Oklahoma, made a bizarre arrest after they got a call on a man who covered himself in cooking oil and then made suggestive proposals to children. A neighbor said, "It's like I'm living in a damn nut house."
I love that story. We should read that story next hour, too, exactly the same way, because it's going to be equally awesome.
Neighbors have plenty to shout to say about what happened at the apartment complex where they live, especially a recent episode involving a man upstairs who is known as Boo Boo. I was sitting here watching TV, and I heard a little hollering.
Taking place in an episode of the Cosby Kids?
A neighbor said he heard a little hollering. So I opened the door, and there were three police cars sitting outside. But a lot of more happened before police got on the scene. One neighbor said he was stark naked with cooking oil all over him. Chickasha police said they got a call about the neighbor on the second floor, 38-year-old Joseph Branham. Police Chief Lynn Williams said the dispatch center received a call of a naked man making indecent proposals to juvenile females. The male suspect, Mr. Branham, tried to offer them crack cocaine. At some point in time, he went into their bedroom and asked if they would engage in sexual activities with him. Police quickly responded, and once again, the neighbors got a show. One neighbor said they brought him outside with a flashbulb, and they took a picture of him, and he had that oil all over him. Court records state that when officers got on the scene, Branham had sweatpants on and looked to be sweating heavily, but after a closer look, police soon realized he was not sweating, but had lubed himself all over with cooking oil. When asked why, police say Branham told them, quote, because he was getting ready to have some fun.
The best and worst story we've ever had. Does it specify what kind of cooking oil it was?
No.
Are we talking canola? Are we talking olive? Are we talking coconut?
I'm thinking it's probably the cheap kind. It's like your basic, you could have sprayed himself. That would be more efficient.
Now I'm set for an evening's adventure.
Yes.
I imagine he was difficult to restrain long enough to handcuff or whatever, too, because he just kept squirting out of your hand like a bar of soap in a shower.
I think we'll save that one and read that one again next time.
I'm going to have me some fun.
It gets better.
Ethel, lube me.
All right. It's like I'm living in a nut house, said one neighbor.
I don't think it's like you're living in a nut house, sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
An environmental group called Mateel Environment Justice Foundation filed a lawsuit in Orange County Superior Court in April against Walt Disney Parks and Resorts, alleging excessive levels of lead in such commonly touched objects as the Sword in the Stone attraction, where Disneyland photographers encourage children to pose while pulling on the sword handle.
Do they really?
Yes, they do.
Hey, now.
They do. They also note other objects, including the brass doorknobs at Minnie's house and stained glass windows that adorn the entrance to the beauty salon in Cinderella's castle, may be made with lead.
So don't eat the doorknobs, kids.
Mateel President William Varick said in a statement, "We're asking the court to force Disney to take steps that should have been taken when they were first told that children at Disneyland are in danger of illegal lead exposures." In court documents, Disney rejected the allegations in the lawsuit and maintained it had posted adequate warnings about lead-tainted fixtures and figurines as required by law. I've been to Disneyland, by the way, and I don't remember anything like on the Sword in the Stone going, "Warning, contains lead."
No. But I also don't recall anything that said, like, scrape bits of this off and, like, stick it in your mouth.
Put it in your mouth.
Yeah.
The group says it found lead in tests of brass railings, chains, and other fixtures. Dr. Mark Kostick with the Wisconsin Poison Center in Milwaukee says a once or twice a year visit to Disneyland is not likely to poison your child.
Well, so he says.
Being around something or even exposed to something doesn't mean you're poisoned by it. So
you
lead
idiots.
Is ubiquitous in the environment. It's in the soil. You can get the same exposure by going out and playing in your yard as you can from touching a railing.
You can tell just by his tone of voice that he views this as the stupidest question he's received all year, and
yes.
He can't believe he's actually answering it as though it were a legitimate query.
Yeah, I like him.
Yeah.
Testing conducted in June and December called wipe testing aimed to mimic what happens when someone touches lead-tainted items. In those tests, a volunteer wiped his hands with a laboratory version of a moist towelette, then touched windows, brass chains, and doorknobs throughout the park. In each case, the volunteer then wiped the palms and fingers of his hands with a second towelette, which was analyzed by an independent laboratory. The test found hand lead exposures at the Haunted Mansion Peter Pan ride and Mr. Toad's Wild Ride at 1 microgram, 9.75 micrograms, and 5.82 micrograms, respectively. A wipe sample taken from the stained glass Pinocchio window in the dining area of Village House Restaurant found a lead exposure of 350 micrograms. Under state law, warnings are required if exposure for average users exceeds 0.5 micrograms per day.
That's a ridiculous story.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not faulting you for reading it. I'm just saying there's nothing.
No, it's Disney is responsible for a lot of bad things.
Yeah.
But this is just stupid.
That just seems pointless. That's a waste of scientific candle power, Don.
Yes.
That's what that is. All right.
Bastards.
You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget you can get this program later on today via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm. You can take it with you on your mobile device at mobile.cascadia.fm. Next hour, the Rick Emerson Radio Program at rickemersonshow.com. Today, Taser Watch, Geek Watch, and a Nazi Watch, among other items of jubilation and amusement. That's at rickemersonshow.com. Here is Don Taylor.
It may not account too much, but like so many times before, seismologists are paying close attention to a recent swarm of earthquakes on Mount Rainier. Data from the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network show at least 7 earthquakes in the last 2 weeks around the mountain. One of the strongest was last Friday when a 3.5 magnitude quake struck in the afternoon near Ashford. Earlier that day, a 2.9 magnitude quake shook beneath Mount Rainier. Thousands of tiny quakes preceded the eruption of Mount St. Helens 7 years ago as magma was being pushed upward from the deep below. As it were then, scientists say these quakes are also shallow, but not necessarily a warning sign of anything immediate. University of Washington seismologist Steve Malone said, "It helps seeing these types of events over, in my case, decades." In other words, he's like, shut up, nothing's going to happen. Seismologists are also watching eastern Washington, where there have been at least 4 earthquakes in the last few days around a small area on the Columbia River just north of Richland. Coincidentally, a 3.4 magnitude quake struck that area the same day as the Ashford quake near Mount Rainier. However, scientists say the two were not connected. He said, We just have to pay attention. Just keep watching it. That's what the seismologist said.
You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. It is 12:43 for those of you that have someplace you have to be in 17 minutes or, you know, later. Don Taylor and I will be continuing our shenanigans next hour at RickEversonShow.com.
Indeed.
And coming up here in just a moment, we have your entertainment news. Again, don't forget you can get this program later on the day via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here. Can't they, Don?
They can. And
you can see, also, I was handing it right to you there.
You can also hear me later this afternoon on Hamfisted Radio.
There you go.
At 4 p.m. here on Cascadia with Mr. Fatboy Robertson. We will be hanging out with Dave Helfrey, Baron Von Gulo from Fright Town.
And that's going to be happening at 4 p.m. Pacific time right here at Cascadia.fm or later at
hamfistedradio.com.
Fantastic.
Yes. Let's do some. I don't think that makes it sound appealing at all if you end the pitch with the doom music.
Or at hamfistedradio.com. Here's your entertainment news again.
Cable television's polygamous sister wives family is telling a federal judge in Utah how much they've been hurt by the threat of prosecution under the state's bigamy law. Cody Brown and his wives write in new court papers that they lost jobs, were forced to move to Nevada, and suffered harm to their reputations after police launched an investigation last year. The Browns are featured on the TLC program Sister Wives. They filed a lawsuit in July challenging Utah's bigamy statute. The suit filed in U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City contends the state unfairly applies the law to polygamists. State prosecutors have said it is unlikely Brown or his wives would actually be charged with a third-degree felony. State attorneys have asked a federal judge to dismiss the lawsuit. Pete Rugolo, an Emmy and award-winning and Grammy award-winning composer and arranger who worked with greats such as Miles Davis and Benny Goodman, died. He was 95. A family spokeswoman said Rugolo died Sunday in the Sherman Oaks area of Los Angeles. Rugolo was chief arranger for Stan Kenton's orchestra after World War II, helping develop its progressive jazz sound. He later was musical director for Capitol Records, where he signed Peggy Lee, Mel Torme, and others. He produced the Miles Davis Birth of the Cool sessions and Harry Belafonte's first singles. In the 1950s, he got into movie and TV while also recording his own albums. He co-wrote the theme for TV's The Fugitive and wrote themes for other music for many TV shows, including Run for Your Life. A New Jersey university will be the new home for nearly 15,000 documents associated with Bruce Springsteen. Books, concert programs, magazines, and newspaper articles, formerly kept at the Asbury Park Public Library, will be moved to Monmouth University in West Long Branch on November 1st. The material has outgrown the library, which offered viewing by appointment only. The university's Bruce Springsteen Special Collection will be accessible to anyone and have enough space for it to grow, including recordings, film footage, and other documents. Monmouth University President Paul Gaffney II says the school's music industry students will benefit greatly from having access to the documents. The university is about 5 miles from Asbury Park, where Springsteen performed in his early days.
Are you collecting a trove of documents for when they open the Don Taylor Memorial Library or something at some point?
Yes, I have a box of valuable old movie reviews and, my school, programs from school plays and important things that people will want to see back. Yeah.
Like, do you ever think about that? Like, if at some point, at some point after your passing, that they decided to have some sort of a mini retrospective or a collection, an overview of the work and life of Don Taylor, and then they would just go and it would just. Like, in my case, it would just be, it would be like empty Crunch and Munch boxes, like stuck under the cushions of my sofa.
See, but that's not really true, though, because you do actually save everything.
I do.
You keep everything. And I really don't. When I was working in newspapers, Mike Russell, I watched him very carefully archive every single issue of every newspaper he did. And he kept copies of all of the magazines that he had stories in and everything that he did. And I did that for a really long time. And then at some point I needed to move and I realized that I had stacks and stacks and stacks of newspaper that no one was ever going to really care about. And so I ended up just tossing almost all of it. I have a couple of copies of, like, glossy magazines I had, like, interviews with, with, like, directors and things. But all of the newspaper stuff just went. Because I just went, no one is going to want to go back and go, ooh, this was her very first review. Bridget Jones's Diary. That's one for the ages.
Remember when she spoke to McG?
Yeah.
And then just sort of frame it and everybody stands in peaceful contemplation in front of it as it's mounted on the wall.
Yeah, no one's going to give a damn. museum. So, yeah.
So you're going to be like Aristophanes. It'll just be, you know, the fantastic artist of whom we have very, very, you know, little surviving work.
Well, the thing is, if I wanted to, I could actually collect almost all of that stuff because, like, all my movie reviews and stuff are on the internet still. I mean, even the stuff I wrote for the Portland Tribune is almost all still archived. Okay. You can find it online.
So the world is, there's a living museum.
There's a
living Don Taylor exhibit.
A digital museum
all the time.
Don Taylor. And also, God, this is really sad. I blogged on LiveJournal for something like 6 years, and I used this program where you can actually create an archive of all of your blog posts in like one place, and then if you want to, you can actually get it bound into a book. And I never got it bound into a book, but I do have the file that has every single blog post I made for like 6 years on LiveJournal. I don't know why. Maybe when I'm old, I'll go through and I can like look at how trivial my life was once. I have no idea.
Okay.
Twilight star Nikki Reed and American Idol Season 10 contestant Paul McDonald have tied the knot. The couple said, "I do," Sunday at a small ranch ceremony in Malibu, California. McDonald tweeted the news day before yesterday. "Yesterday was the most amazing day of my life. Everything was perfect. I'm officially a married man. Woohoo!" Reed tweeted about the same time, "Yesterday was the most magical day of my life." She was a little bit less excited about it than he was.
I've already forgotten who these people are.
She's somebody who was in Twilight, and he's a guy who was on American Idol.
Okay.
I wouldn't know them. If you could put them in the room with us right now, I would have no idea.
Yeah,
who
it's like
are,
you said their names like 35 seconds ago, and by the end of that sentence, I had already forgotten.
Yeah, they met on the red carpet of the Little Red Riding Hood premiere in March. And McDonald popped the question in June.
Okay.
Oh, I think those crazy kids are going to make it.
Destined for immortality,
yeah.
There.
A judge has granted Selena Gomez a temporary restraining order from a man with a history of mental illness who police say threatened her. Court records show the Wizards of Waverly Place star was granted the order Thursday in Burbank, which is north of downtown Los Angeles. Thomas Brodnicki is required to stay 100 yards away from Gomez and her workplace until a November 4th hearing, when the order may be extended for 3 years. Gomez wrote in a sworn declaration that she is in extreme fear of Brodnicki. The filings, first reported Monday by celebrity website TMZ, said the state police were notified by mental health workers that the 46-year-old had threatened to harm or kill the actress while he was on a psychiatric hold.
Okay.
So that's happening. The Anti-Defamation League has called on Susan Sarandon to apologize for calling Pope Benedict the 16th a Nazi. During an interview at the Bay Street Theater in Long Island, Newsday reports the Oscar-winning actress made her controversial comment while discussing her 1995 film Dead Man Walking, which was based on an anti-death penalty book by sister Helen Prejean.
Wait, since when does the Anti-Defamation League want to call fewer people Nazis?
I know.
Seems like they're,
is it?
I mean, and also, I mean, I guess we could call him a former Nazi. That would be accurate.
Sarandon remembered she had sent a copy of the book to the Pope, and then she said, "The last one, not this Nazi one we have now."
That's awesome. She's even, you know, just when you think she can't somehow become hotter, then she does. Well done.
The Anti-Defamation League responded on Monday asking Sarandon to apologize to the Catholic community and anybody else she may have offended with her remarks. Ms. Sarandon may have her differences with the Catholic Church, but that's no excuse for throwing around Nazi analogies.
It's not an analogy. He was...
said the Anti-Defamation League.
That's not an analogy. That is, in fact... the only way that you could modify that, I think, to make it arguably more accurate is to say he was a Nazi or is a former Nazi.
Right. Yeah, because it says here, it's unclear whether Sarandon was commenting generally about the Pope's current policies or on his childhood experiences with the Nazi Party during World War II.
I think it's based on the fact that he was actually a member of the Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
I think that's really what they mean by Nazi. Also,
a Nazi.
He's a creepy German guy who wears ruby slippers.
Right.
But, I mean, that's sort of a separate issue. So,
In other celebrity stalking news, a judge ruled Monday the man charged with stalking Halle Berry should stand trial on two charges filed after he was repeatedly seen on her property earlier this year. Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Melissa Whittefield issued her ruling after hearing from two witnesses called during a preliminary hearing to show evidence against Richard A. Franco, who's pleaded not guilty to burglary and stalking charges. L.A. Police Detective John Gregozek testified that when Franco was caught, he was carrying a key to Berry's guest house, where she has her beauty salon and some of her wardrobe. Maybe he didn't really want to harm her. He just wanted to try on her clothes.
Was Gregorzek, is that your punting name at like a Polish, your punting attempt at a Polish name that takes up half the page with like a lot of Z's?
No,
in it?
It's actually spelled Gregorzek.
Okay, all right.
Gregozek.
Occasionally I'll hear a name like that spoken aloud by somebody, and then I, in my mind's eye, I just see one of those like Przybylowski names that just takes up, you know, or Krzyzewski, but it doesn't look anything like that because it's nothing but Q's and Y's.
Mr. Presbo.
Yes, exactly.
Franco was standing outside her kitchen door when Barry spotted him and locked the door and called police.
So, hey, back on Susan Tarana for a second.
Yeah.
You know, I have nothing really more to say about it, except, again, I love the idea that she just, you know, she just sort of blithely said, not the Nazi guy we've got now. But I was taking a good long look at that Eva Murray chick, her daughter with Chris Sarandon.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Eva Murray. She really is, like, from the neck down, she's really attractive. From the neck up, not so much. And also, she doesn't look like either of her parents. Like, I was trying to figure out, like, where does that unfortunate face of hers come from? And they're really, like, it doesn't look like Chris Sarandon.
Well, Chris Sarandon is kind of a weird-looking guy.
Yeah, and it doesn't really look like Susan Sarandon. It kind of looks, you know what it looks like? Here's what Eva Murray, and by the way, if you don't know who Eva Murray is, she was, most notably, she was in season 3 of Californication as the blonde student that seduces David Duchovny.
She has her mother's eyes, but nothing else looks like.
Here's what it is. I figured it out. She has her mother's eyes, and then she has a little bit of Chris Sarandon and Susan Sarandon's facial structure, but then she has all of Jerry Lewis's head from when he was all strung out on steroids and prednisone. And he was all pumpkin-headed. It's like you just put an air pump in the back, like in one of her ears, and just went and just started to inflate her cheeks.
By the way, Chris Sarandon is not her father.
No, so who is her father?
Her father is an Italian director named Franco Amari.
Okay, well, that at least would explain why she doesn't look like Chris. I always thought that she was the daughter of Susan Sarandon and Chris Sarandon.
No.
Okay, all right. Well, that is less. That solves one part of the mystery.
She was married to Chris Sarandon when they were in college, and they actually got divorced early on, very early in both their careers. She just kept the name.
Okay, all right. What is it? Well, so when was she married? When was she with Italian director guys? After Chris Sarandon, presumably?
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah, obviously. I'm not sure.
Okay.
See if I can. She was married to him. She actually dated him in the mid-80s.
All right.
So she never actually married him.
I have to know all of this, of course, so someday when I'm, you know, when we're sharing a candlelight dinner, that's Susan Sarandon and I, you know, that I can speak knowledgeably about her life.
Yeah, she started dating Chris Sarandon when they were both in college. They got married in 1967, and they got divorced in 79.
Well, he was really there for the salad days.
Yeah.
Good for you, Chris Sarandon. Well done.
She was also with Louis Malle for 2 years, which when you see how beautifully he photographs her in Atlantic City, you know that they're sleeping together.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, come on.
All right. We got like 2 minutes here.
Well, let's. Vice President Joseph Biden continued to push the American Jobs Act.
Wait, hold on. This is not entertaining.
No,
we're
done with entertainment.
And I hear Joe Biden and the entertainment stops.
No, yeah. There's no more entertainment in this show.
No.
None at all. Now we're just coasting towards the end.
If I had a sound that was just sort of the low rumbling drone of like a hairdryer, that's what I would play here.
Well, forget. Then I'm not going to talk about Joe Biden because
no one
wants
to hear
about
that. No,
you
can if you want.
I'm going to read something imminently more interesting.
Okay.
A Tampa Bay area collector has made the Guinness Book of World Records for owning more autographed baseballs than anyone, including the Hall of Fame.
That's really interesting.
Yes. Dennis Rader has 4,600 autographed baseballs.
Uh-huh.
All stored at his vault in Odessa, Florida.
That's great.
The 65-year-old mobile home executive.
Wow, this keeps getting more interesting with every passing sentence.
He started almost 60 years ago when he got Mickey Mantle's autograph at spring training. His favorite ball is signed by Babe Ruth and 10 other Hall of Famers who attended the opening of the Cooperstown, New York Museum in 1939. Another ball was signed by Joe DiMaggio and actress Marilyn Monroe during their brief marriage. The balls are worth $3 million.
He's 75 years young.
They're displayed in a room that has walls a foot thick, a bank vault door, motion sensors, and video surveillance.
Hey, Willard Scott or something? Okay.
And he's having a ball in Cooperstown.
Okay. Just for that, you got a little bit of the...
His balls are worth $3 million.
All right, Jacob. Okay. Well,
one of his balls was signed by Marilyn Monroe.
No. We're just going to end now. With that, Christ almighty, we bring the curtain down on this another exciting episode of Legion of News. We will see you again tomorrow. That is Thursday at noon. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high over the milk packing district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon, at the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show is next at rickemersonshow.com. Today, Nazi Watch, Taser Watch, Geek Watch, and more. Don't forget, you can get this program later on the day via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here or at legionofnews.com. From all of us here at Legion of News, the Emerson News Network, and Cascadia.fm, thank you for listening. Have a safe and satisfying Wednesday, won't you?